Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence brief on the war for the free world. We have the privilege of having with us today a man of, well, a pedigreed intelligence. He is a member of the Mensa Society, a certified genius. His name is George Raisley. I call him a friend as well as a much admired colleague. He is these days the editor-in-chief of Richard Viguerie's Conservative HQ newsletter, a terrific publication and resource. He is also a man who has had extensive experience in political affairs in our country, having worked in and on something on the order of 300 campaigns, including many of the most recent presidential ones. It's very good to have you with us, George Raisley. Thank you very much for taking some time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
The pleasure truly is mine. As you've been writing, George, at Conservative HQ on a couple of topics that are very much top of mind for me and I think for our audience. Let's start with one that involves a veteran of the United States Air Force by the name of Ashley Babbitt, now deceased, alas, under circumstances that remain unclear. She was killed by an as yet unidentified law enforcement individual inside the Capitol on the occasion of the so-called insurrection there on the 6th of January. Talk a bit about what we have learned about Ashley Babbitt, or more to the point, not learned about her demise, and the precedent that's been established that's quite troubling.
Well, the notion that the riot at the Capitol was an insurrection is complete nonsense unless, you're an insurrectionist for trespassing, which is what most of the individuals who've been arrested or indicted have been charged with. No one's been charged with insurrection or anything like that at all. And the situation with Ms. Babbitt is particularly troubling because we know nothing, absolutely nothing, about the justification for her killing, which appears to be a police officer of apparently the Capitol Police firing into an unarmed crowd. And this is completely unprecedented in the United States, going back to, pre-revolutionary times. I mean, one of the sparks for the American Revolution was the so-called Boston Massacre in 1770, where British troops fired into an unarmed crowd. And it's worth noting that within hours, they were arrested, thrown in jail, put on trial for murder, which was a capital offense, and ultimately defended by patriot and founding father of our country, John Adams, who thought it was important to have what happened aired and have them have a competent defense. And they were all found innocent of murder, and two of them were convicted of manslaughter. And sentenced, oddly enough, to be branded on their thumbs, which was the punishment for manslaughter back then. The same precedent in the Kent State killings 200 years later in 1970, the National Guardsmen who fired on an unarmed crowd were ultimately charged. There was a lengthy trial, numerous public inquiries, so to speak, and they were all found innocent, although the judge admonished the state and the National Guard, saying that while they were not guilty of the charges, the actions that they undertook were, let me see if I can remember exactly what he said. Such use of force is and was deplorable. And we have no opportunity for any of that in the Ashley Babbitt killing. The officer who shot her is unknown. His justification for doing so has never been stated publicly. There have been no public inquiries whatsoever into the whole matter. And, you know, this secrecy and lack of transparency and accountability are unprecedented in our country. As I said, going back to, you know, pre-revolutionary times.
So, George, what you're saying is that basically we are being denied information we have a need to know, a right to know, about who did this killing. And to get clarification as to what the circumstances are, is it because this confounds the narrative that we're being told that we're being denied that information, do you think?
Well, yeah, I think that's part of it. But my concern, Frank, is the precedent that this sets, which is that the police can fire into unarmed crowds with no fear of any sort of accountability. Now, stop and think about who does that. The czarist regime in pre-revolutionary Russia, the communist Chinese in Tiananmen Square, the socialist government of Venezuela. So this is a truly astonishing departure from, you know, the standards of American justice and how the government uses force against its citizens.
And this comes at the moment, and we're watching an immense amount of attention focused on every police shooting in this country when it involves people of a certain race or people of a certain, shall we say, ideology. In this case, that didn't apply to this white Air Force veteran who was there to protest basically what she saw as the fraud in the 2020 elections.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it appears that if you're a drug dealer with a weapons warrant or some other miscreant and you encounter the police and they shoot you, you're a saint. If you're a conservative protesting the what you see as a fraudulent election, you're fair game. And can be shot on sight. And that certainly cannot stand as the basis for governing this country.
Amen. George Raceley, we have to take a break. And I want to come back to this question of the narrative about what happened in the 2020 election race and take advantage of your very extensive experience with election campaigns to describe what went wrong there, of why people like Ashley Babbitt and others were right to be deeply concerned about these elections. What's being done in states across America to try to assure that there isn't a repetition of what I think of as electoral grand larceny, but also countervailing efforts now being made in the Congress in the form of this legislation known as H.R. 1 or S.1 in the Senate, and where this would leave the country were it to be enacted. We'll be talking about all of that and more with George Raceley of Conservative HQ right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are continuing our conversation with the editor of Conservative HQ, a terrific newsletter of the Richard Viguerie Organization. His name is George Raceley. He is a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, a valued friend and colleague, and we're visiting with him a bit about what went on the 6th of January and what we've been misled to believe actually happened there and efforts that are afoot to try to cover up the truth. What we're interested in getting your take on as well, George, is as an experienced hand in political campaigning, talk to us about your assessment of what actually did happen on, the November 3rd and the run-up to it and in the days that followed it. this election 2020, particularly for President Trump's reelection?
Well, one of the things that happened on November 3rd was that a whole series of what I call extra constitutional measures were taken, such as unmonitored drop boxes for absentee ballots, massive mailing of unsolicited absentee ballots into certain Democrat-heavy precincts in swing states, all funded outside of the government budget, I might add, by Mark Zuckerberg and others. Those measures were taken with the intention of using the power of local election administrators to tilt the election to Biden and the Democrats. And this is, again, an unprecedented situation in the United States. You know, I've been a precinct election worker for many elections. I can recall in the early days of my political career, one of my mentors sent me to a heavily Democrat precinct where there were exactly four Republican votes that could be counted. And the idea was just to make sure that the Democrats didn't pull any shenanigans there. The election was run very transparently. The votes were counted on the machines. Everybody signed a form attesting to that. The machines were looked at before the poll was opened. They were looked at before it closed to make sure that there were no anomalies, so to speak, in the tally of the votes. And it was all, you know, Republicans and Democrats being there, countersigning everybody's forms. So it was all completely open. A lot of that has been eroded over the last 30 years through court action, where activist judges have set aside these safeguards, and through, frankly, Republicans being wimpy and wanting to be loved by the media rather than standing for rigorous enforcement of the election laws.
And George, I guess this is the thing that's so troubling, is that we have been incessantly told none of that is true, that there was no fraud, absolutely no fraud is often the case, and certainly none that would have made a material impact on the election. How do we square the narrative that has been force-fed to us, mostly by the media, but also by politicians to some extent on the Republican side of the aisle too, incredibly, with the facts as you've just described them?
Well, it's impossible to believe that there was no fraud in the election when there were literally thousands of untracked absentee ballots floating around in cities and counties across America. I mean, in Nevada, there's affidavits, plenty of evidence demonstrating that there were literally hundreds of ballots just dropped in apartment building lobbies and places like that. In Georgia and in Nevada, there's, again, tons of irrefutable evidence that absentee ballots were allegedly sent to vacant lots, to storefronts, to mail boxes at places like UPS stores and stuff like that. Again, completely illegal, contrary to any to election laws and to any concept of a rigorous enforcement of election integrity.
Well, this brings me to the point that there are a number of states in the country now, notably Georgia, but Texas and Arizona and others, that are working on electoral reform legislation to try to ensure that there is no repetition of these horrors. And yet we're watching this intense pushback, notably from prominent corporations in America, but also obviously Democrats and the media. What are we to make of that, George? And again, what are the stakes if they succeed in suppressing such reforms?
Well, the states have actually been doing a good job in identifying those problems and attempting to address them through legislation. And the problem is that you have these so-called woke corporations, Coca-Cola, Delta Airlines, Procter & Gamble, who have, in essence, joined the other side. And make no mistake about it, these companies are political organizations. They are taking the shareholders' money and the vast profits that they reap by being global leaders in these various sectors and putting them behind left-wing political objectives, climate change, all of the social justice agenda, and these election reforms and clarifications, and in some cases, restatement of existing law, are in their way. And that's why they're trying to undermine these efforts in state legislatures.
This is critical to an accurate understanding of where we find ourselves now. It's also critical, George, to informing how we perceive what Democrats in Congress are trying to do to create a permanent national election process that would negate any such efforts at the state level, arguably unconstitutionally at that. What do you make of this so-called H.R. 1 and S. 1 in the Senate legislation, George, and the stakes associated with the efforts the Democrats are making now, even to the point perhaps of eliminating the filibuster, at least for this purpose, for, you know, the future of free and fair elections in this country?
Well, make no mistake about it. I mean, their intention is to create the means of accomplishing a one-party state. And in the process, they will suppress free speech. They will enable a whole host of election changes. I won't call them reforms. I won't dignify them with that name. Election law changes, which will make it easier to steal elections. And that's what this is all about. I mean, you have to understand that elections should be easy to cast your vote and hard to cheat. And what they're trying to do through H.R. 1 and S. 1 is make it easier to cheat. And so all of these untracked absentee ballots and all the other stuff, these unmonitored drop boxes, will be institutionalized in federal law. And that would completely undermine the state legislation, which in some cases has been there for years, and in other cases is being passed in state legislatures right now, and even as we speak.
That's the kicker, is that if those state-level efforts are essentially permanently precluded, and the sorts of activities that were allowed in, or being tolerated at least, in the 2020 race become enshrined in federal statute, it does seem to me it's no exaggeration to say there won't be another authentically free and fair election in this country. And that's a pretty chilling prospect, and one that I think has to be resisted with every opportunity we have to persuade our representatives not to go there. And I pray that we will be successful in that. Thank you for your leadership in this regard, and that of Richard Viguerie, with whom you work at Conservative HQ. Let me ask you finally, and very briefly, to talk a little bit about your concerns about Joe Biden surrendering to Islamic supremacism in Afghanistan. We're going to visit shortly about all this with Robert Spencer at a little bit greater length, but I'd like to get your take on that as well, George Raisling.
Well, as I said in my recent column on that, we're surrendering in a war that we never really fought, and that despite the valor on the battlefield of our people who were killed there, and the 20,000 some who were left with life-changing wounds and injuries, we never fought this war as a whole of government, a whole of culture battle that it is. And, the Islamic supremacists, having in essence, defeated us in Afghanistan, will be emboldened. And make no mistake about it, they're going to follow us home because they understand that this is a whole of culture war, and that's how they intend to fight it. That's how they have been fighting it. And we, on the other hand, sort of treated it as a, you know, tribal conflict that we were supposed to be refereeing, or, you know, a fight for some godforsaken territory that only the Afghans really want, and who, you know, they're happy to leave when they're given the chance, because if you've ever been to Afghanistan, it's not exactly a garden spot in most cases.
That's for sure. George Raceley, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for your time today, as well as the great work that you do at conservativehq.com. Please, folks, check it out. It is required reading each day. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we'll speak with Robert Spencer about more on the jihad here as well as elsewhere, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. And it's a delight always to be able to say welcome to our next guest. His name is Robert Spencer. He is these days a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. He is also the director of a terrific online resource. It's called Jihad Watch. Among Robert's other extraordinary accomplishments is he is the author of some 21 books, the most recent of which can be pre-ordered now. It is an expanded edition of his bestseller, Did Muhammad Exist? Robert, it's good to have you with us as always. Welcome back. Several things are top of my mind, and let's go through them quickly. One is John Kerry has been described by the foreign minister of Iran as having provided him with information about some 200 Israeli operations against Iran in Syria. We're not quite sure what the timing of all of this was, but it does sound to me as though this is the latest in a long line of betrayals of our country by the former Secretary of State. What did you make of this?
Well, I hope the Israelis are taking careful note of the fact that Kerry is once again in the administration, once again powerful and influential in directing the course of the American government. And that bodes very ill for the U.S.-Israeli alliance. But what Kerry did in revealing the details of covert Israeli actions to the Iranian is consistent with his behavior through the years. First, in concluding the disastrous Iran nuclear deal that essentially gives a green light to Iran to develop nuclear weapons, contrary to popular belief. And then in undermining as much as he could the Trump administration's attempts to stymie the Iranian activities in aiding terror groups around the world and in renewing sanctions on Iran and so on. So Kerry continues to aid Iran, secure in the knowledge that his friends and allies and colleagues in the judicial system who see the world in the same way that he does are never going to hold him to account.
Let me just ask Robert about this stunning outcome in what's called the Court of Cassation in France, the Supreme Court of the land, with respect to the murderer of a woman who he seemingly beat and then shoved out a window simply because she was Jewish. Her name is Sarah Halimi. Talk a little bit about the outcome of this trial.
The decision is absurd in the first place because the French court decided that they were not going to try the killer because he was high on marijuana at the time. Now, he was screaming Allahu Akbar and railing about the Jews and Islam when he threw the woman out the window and killed her. And so the idea that this is because he was high on marijuana, well, you know, millions of people get high on marijuana on a fairly regular basis, and they don't end up throwing people out windows. So the decision is very clearly a manifestation of the cowardice of the French establishment in refusing to confront Islamic anti-Semitism, refusing to confront the jihad activity that is growing in France, and refusing to anger their already fairly angry Muslim community in France, which is angry because of counter-terror measures that have attempted to be implemented since the beheading of a school teacher for showing a cartoon of Muhammad.
Hmm. It seems they're angry also, Robert Spencer, and you know a lot about this, because they are told to be angry. They are told to be jihadists. Sharia, the doctrine they adhere to, directs them to manifest this effort to dominate the other, the infidel most especially. And so it is part of the sort of climate of fear, it seems, that the French are now responding to, and doing so in a way that I am concerned is likely to convey to these jihadist elements and the Muslim community more broadly a willingness on the part of the French to submit. And again, your studies in the dictates of Sharia and the purpose that jihad plays in advancing that sort of submission is indispensable to understanding what's really going on here and the stakes for not just France, but for Europe, and I think for the rest of us as well, if we follow suit. Robert, I want to, speaking of jihadism, turn to another piece that you had on the jihadwatch.org site recently. It addresses a topic that I think has gotten altogether too little attention, namely the efforts that are being made by the jihadists to take advantage of, things like our porous borders, I'm sure, but also the protests that are taking place across this country to act against our police and our society. Talk a little bit about this piece in the so-called Wolves of Manhattan magazine.
Wolves of Manhattan is a pro-Al-Qaeda magazine, and it is one of the many, actually, quite well-produced, well-designed, glossy publications that are available pretty much readily online for jihadis. And it calls for lone wolf attacks in the United States by individual Muslims, telling them to go to protests and take advantage of the chaos by appearing to share the views of the protesters. And when I read that, I thought, well, that's not going to be very hard, because both the protesters and the jihadis hate the West, hate Judeo-Christian civilization, and so on, and mount attacks on police officers, which is also something that is likely to be applauded by the protesters present, or many of them. So they are taking advantage of the prevailing anti-Americanism on the radical left to exploit it for their own purposes.
And to the extent that they succeed at this, we're likely to see an undercurrent, at least, if not even more overt manifestation of the radicalism, not just of jihadists of the Al-Qaeda stripe, but perhaps of the Muslim Brotherhood stripe as well. Their organizational differences not being as important as their shared objectives, and to some extent, their common tactics, right?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. And these groups very much work in sync or follow one another's lead. As a matter of fact, the very existence of this glossy magazine is something that originated with Al-Qaeda, and then ISIS picked it up, and now Al-Qaeda has taken it to the next level. And in the same way, you had just a few months ago, actually, during the protests last summer, there was a lawyer in New York City, a Muslim woman, who threw a Molotov cocktail into a police car. And it turned out that she had extensive connections to pro-Palestinian groups, Muslim Brotherhood-linked groups, and so on. And so it's clear that Wolves of Manhattan is not the first to think that there is a connection between the global jihad and these protests by the left in America.
Robert, let me pivot to one other that you feature prominently at Jihad Watch at the moment, and that is the implications of the U.S. departure from Afghanistan that President Biden has directed by the 11th of September, the 20th anniversary of the attack on the United States that precipitated invasion of that country. What are Muslims, not just the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and ISIS, which are operating in that country, likely to take away from our departure, but also the Sharia supremacists more generally around the world.
Well, there's no doubt that they will see it as a great victory. And that is likely to be true whenever we left. There are people who are saying we shouldn't leave. We have to make sure that the Taliban doesn't regain power. Well, how long is that going to take? The problem is that the Taliban has broad popular support. And pretty much any time we left, they're going to exploit our departure. We need to reconfigure our response to that by focusing on making sure that they can't export their jihad while not trying anymore to impose a government on Afghanistan that they don't want and is likely to topple as soon as the great benefactor is gone. But the thing is, the choice of the September 11th date by the Biden administration couldn't be more unfortunate. After all, it is widely believed by many Muslims and non-Muslims that Osama bin Laden chose September 11th for the 2001 attacks because of the breaking of the siege of Vienna, the high water mark of Ottoman jihadist expansion in Europe on September 11, 1683. And he was essentially saying, now we're picking up where we left off then. And so to leave Afghanistan on September 11th is also to reaffirm that the jihad has been victorious, the forces arrayed against the jihad have been defeated. And there is absolutely no doubt that that is how this will be presented in large sectors of the Islamic world.
Emboldening them, and I fear probably other enemies of this country as well. Lastly, and very quickly, Robert, I did want to just call out to our audience's attention a piece that you commented on that ran in Newsweek recently by Obaid Omar, a former Muslim who talks about some of your life experiences and mine, I guess, when he describes the techniques that have been used to try to silence the sorts of informed criticisms and warnings about the jihadists' agenda and Sharia supremacism more generally. Talk a little bit about his essay and its timeliness.
Well, it was extraordinary that Newsweek published it, and I'm glad that they did. He describes in the article being raised as a Muslim, leaving Islam, and then finding to his dismay that criticism of Islam, including opposition to jihad violence and Sharia oppression of women and others in the West, was considered to be racist, even though, of course, Islam is not a race, and there are Muslims of all races, and there are Islamic jihadis of all race. And so he realized that this was an extraordinary tactic that had been employed to stifle all criticism of jihad violence, any honest analysis of its root causes in Islamic texts and teachings, and any criticism of Sharia, even in its most oppressive aspect. And he sees this, of course, as an extremely negative development as an ex-Muslim, as it's going to further inhibit people who might have spoken out against these injustices and cruelties. And so I think, well, yeah, welcome to my world, Obaid Omar, and I hope that maybe your voice will be heard where ours was not.
Thank you, Robert Spencer, for helping us understand the multiple dimensions of some of these challenges and how we best respond to them.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're joined by one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very pleased to say. His name is Colonel John Mills, United States Army retired, a former special operator who has specialization in psychological operations and cyber warfare. He served both in uniform and as a civilian in the Defense Department. In his civilian capacity, he was the director of the Cybersecurity Policy Shop in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He has been a very active and, I think, extraordinarily important contributor to the work of the Committee on the Present Danger, China. Indeed, was the lead drafter of a new white paper the committee released yesterday concerning Taiwan, the threat to that island, and the need to defend against it in the face of growing, it seems, signs that communist China is preparing to invade it and take down the, well, sovereign democracy that has developed there as part of sort of front lines of the free world. John Mills, it's good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us to talk a little bit about this white paper, which you contributed to mightily, and why it's important that it be released at this juncture in particular.
Yeah, good morning, Frank, and thank you. It's an honor as always. We're, for years, we've operated under this concept, kind of an unstated policy of strategic ambiguity on Taiwan. That worked when there was resolve and capability behind the strategic ambiguity. When there's ambiguity behind the strategic ambiguity and questions on resolve, that doesn't work. Very bad that happened. And we need to immediately be demonstrative, be visible, be clear and unambiguous that there is a red line on Taiwan. And it's not just about defense of liberty and a sovereign republic. It is about us because they're not stopping with Taiwan and they are a critical supplier of chips, microelectronics to the U.S. They are critical. This is like Detroit or the Los Angeles aircraft industry being seized by the Axis powers during World War II and us just going, well, oh well.
Yeah, it's really important. You're absolutely right. And the point was made yesterday by Steve Bannon when we jointly appeared on his program that this means that we all really have a stake in this. It's not some abstraction, as you say, John Mills. This brings me to the question of what do we do about this? If we, first of all, and I think most importantly, clarify that there will be a certain defense of Taiwan, not strategic ambiguity, we hopefully can help avoid what might otherwise be miscalculation on the Chinese Communist Party's part, that they would think that they can act with impunity and their costs will be minimal. What can we do, John, to strengthen our deterrence to such action by the Chinese, and most especially to increase the costs to them so that any such calculation is informed by the most, you know, clear indications that they will be very high indeed?
To you. Thank you, Frank. Essentially, two basic lines of effort. One is provide Taiwan everything it needs to defend itself. Everything. And a lot of this is very simple. Stockage of ammunition and missiles. A lot of these can be taken out of U.S. War Reserve immediately and moved to Taiwan to bulk them up. You don't want them to have a shortage of ammunition in a cross-Taiwan Strait missile shootout. You want them to have as much ammunition as they need. We need to make sure all of their platforms, their ground platforms, their aircraft, their missiles have all the logistic support that they need. That's the key enabler, logistic support. There's no shortage of spare parts. We don't want aircraft that can't take off because they're short of spare parts. So we need to flow that now. And a lot of this are already in place. We have a lot of these items in National War Reserve. We need to flow them now. The second is to build up essentially the U.S. backstop, that the legal framework is the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, the 2018 Travel Act. We need to make sure we have staff liaisons going on between INDOPACOM, Indo-Pacific Command in Hawaii. We need to see 3 and 4 stars out there. We need to see battle staffs coordinating, and we need to see a dramatic acceleration of the Pacific pivot, which Kurt Campbell declared in 2010, and then shortly followed by the DOD winter of everything because of the massive cuts in DOD starting at the same time. So Kurt Campbell is a key driver in this in the NSC. Let's see that Pacific pivot. Let's see an acceleration now. That the last 2 years have seen a dramatic acceleration of naval capability of the PLAN. This is very concerning. I love the Navy. They're the lead in this. And Navy and Air Force, Army's in support. We may have to cut resources from Army to get more to Navy and Air Force. But the Navy's been challenged, and they've been in a lot of activity, but they've been stuck in neutral for 10 to 15 years in, you know, just deploying the littoral combat ship, which was supposed to be a key part of present in the Pacific forward areas, and just has been a very disappointing failure. Good idea, horribly executed. So the backstop. So number one, arm up Taiwan. Number two, create that backstop.
It's interesting, and we could get into a longer discussion about the literal ship, John, but I think your point is very well taken, that at the time we were building at prodigious expense, not very capable, essentially, brown water ships, coastal vessels. The Chinese were ramping up dramatically their blue water fleet, and seemingly with a very concerted focus on being able to project power, notably against Taiwan. In addition to the sorts of things that you've mentioned, John, it seemed to me another important piece of the white paper was the emphasis that was recommended on having allied participation in the effort to dissuade the Chinese from invading Taiwan. You talked about having, you know, a permanent allied carrier battle group with American participation in the South China Sea. This would involve other navies in addition to the U.S. Is that practicable as you see it? Is it something that there is a seeming common desire on the part of the so-called Quad, the Japanese, the Indians, the Australians, as well as the United States, and perhaps throw in the French and the Brits as well, in terms of making such a sustained presence possible? And if it is possible, do you think it will really make a material difference to the Chinese?
Yeah, that demonstrates resolve. This is so important because there's a term in Asia, parades mean something. Parades don't mean anything anymore in the U.S. They mean something. They are demonstrations of resolve. A naval parade of keeping an allied carrier battle group between the Quad, Japan, Australia, India, and the U.S., and the Quad Plus, including the Brits and the French, keeping a combined carrier battle group always in the South or Seas, plus another one very close by to come in and provide additional support and capability, demonstrates resolve. The Brits have actually been very good about this. There's already been a deployed with one of their two new carriers, and we're actually putting a marine aircraft on the British carrier, and we're actually adding ship to the battle groups. That's extremely important. And so right now, having those coalition carrier battle groups. Now, the naysayers say, oh, they're vulnerable to all these Chinese capabilities. Yes, there are concerns. However, we demonstrate resolve when we have those. So we want one forward carrier battle group at all time, another one close by to provide cover and support. So this is extremely important.
A lot of this, John, as you've really indicated, is, you know, psychological as well as material and physical. We need to be bringing all of that to bear. You know a good bit about the psychological warfare dimensions of all of this, but we appreciate your acumen on both sides of this ledger, and we look forward to the hopeful response of the administration to the recommendations the Committee on the Present Danger China has made here. The white paper, folks, can be found at presentdangerchina.org. I commend it to you, as I do the great work of our friend John Mills and the committee more generally. This white paper is really timely and important. Thanks for your time to lay it out for us today, John. Come back to us again soon, if you would. In the meantime, stay well. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.